All right, I call the meeting of the Legacy Finance Committee to order. Welcome to our first committee hearing of this year so far. It's really good to see all of you again. And we do have a quorum, and so we'll move approval of the minutes first, and then this hearing is all informational, so we don't have any bills, and we won't be making any motions besides for the minutes. So we have minutes from April 4th, 2025. Would anyone like to move the minutes? Vice Chair Scraba?
So moved to approve the minutes.
All right. We have a motion to approve the minutes from April 4th. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. The motion prevails and the minutes are approved. So members, we do have a new staff on the Outdoor Heritage Council, so I would like members to sort of give yourself a reintroduction to introduce your name and your district where you represent and something you're looking forward to this year, or if you've broken your New Year's resolution already. And welcome Christina as our new executive director for the Outdoor Heritage. And so I would like members to reintroduce herself so that we can welcome Christina to the committee. So I'm Samantha Vang. I represent Brooklyn Center and Brooklyn Park. And something I'm looking forward to is ice melting. So. All right. And we'll go with staff, and then members will come around the circle.
Co-Chair Vang, members, my name is Mike Molzon. I'm DFL committee administrator.
Well, I'm Brad Hagemer, the nonperson host fiscal analysis department.
Janelle Taylor with host research.
Vice Chair, Co-Chair, Representative Hussein, District 65A, and welcome.
Thank you. Leon Lilly, former member of your commission, not anymore.
Representative Hulda Hiltzley, thank you for coming. Glad to have you here.
Representative Chad Woodbury, 47B.
Representative Roger Scraba, District 3A, also a member of the LCCMR.
Representative Bjorn Olson, District 22A, which is just about everything south of Mankato in that center Minnesota portion.
Representative John Burkle, District 1A, Northwest Minnesota.
Representative Tom DePell, Cottage Grove, Hastings area. I'm looking forward to enjoying Minnesota's natural resources this year.
Rep Heitzman, the Brainerd Lakes area.
Amy Zipko, GOP committee administrator.
And Isabel Anderson, DFL committee legislative assistant.
All right, thank you everyone. I see Co-Chair McDonald is just in time.
Hello.
Co-Chair, I was just having members reintroduce themselves because we do have a new executive director on the Outdoor Heritage, so if you could say a couple remarks too.
I heard that. Thank you, Madam Chair. I heard we have a new person on board, so welcome.
Representative McDonald from, good morning, Representative Lilly. How are you today?
Doing good, sir.
Good. You have a great smile. Anyway, sorry, I digress. McDonald from Ray County, and my second term, eighth term actually on the in the House here. So I've been here way too long.
You mean second year of Legacy?
Thank you, Representative Hussein. Yes, it is. It's a long walk from that hallway. So,
all right, thank you, Co-Chair McDonald. So we'll get started with our first item of Jay, Representative Zhang. Reintroduce yourself. We do have a new executive director on the council.
Welcome. My name is Jay. I chair the Veterans Committee, and this is the third term I've sat on this committee.
Great. Thank you.
All right. And then do we have Pages here, too? All right. If you can introduce yourself. All right.
Morning, Madam Chair, members. My name is Eric Overstar. This is my second year in this committee and second year as a page for the House. Happy to be here. Looking forward to the food trucks in the spring.
That's a good one.
And then all right. Thank you. All right. So we'll get going with our first order of business, which is a presentation from the Outdoor Heritage Fund. And so please introduce yourselves and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, legislative members, staff. As Madam Chair said, I'm Christina Smitten, the newest member of the Lisard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council staff. I'm excited to be here. This is a little bit full circle for me. I began my work, my professional experience at the DNR Waters, and was in the public sector for about 10 years, and for the best 20 years I've been in the private sector. So I'm hoping to bring both skills and background to this role going forward. I'm thrilled to be able to work with really exceptional staff. With me today is Assistant Director Joe Pavelko. Also, Tom Redman and Sandy Smith are here. If there's any questions that I'm unable to answer, I'll defer to them. So thank you for having me today. Again, I am thrilled to be here. It's a privilege to be able to work on behalf of the Lisard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council, legislators, and citizens of Minnesota. So I know all of you have some familiarity and some probably deep familiarity with the Legacy Amendment and the Lisard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council, but Mr. Pavelko and I plan to provide a high-level background on the Legacy Amendment. The Lisard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council will pause, and then we'll provide some background on the ML 2026 fiscal year 2027 proposed bill that will be coming before you in the future. With that, Madam Chair, would you like us to get going?
Yes, thank you.
So members, there is a, Madam Chair and members, there is a slide presentation that we'll walk through here. Again, quick high level background information on the Legacy Amendment and the Outdoor Heritage Fund. Thanks, Joe. As you're aware, in 2008, the Clean Water Land and Legacy Amendment was passed by voters. It's a constitutional amendment that expires in 25 years, so that's 2034. This constitutional amendment, voters supported an increase in sales and use tax of 0.375% to benefit clean water, land, and legacy. Within the Clean Water Land and Legacy Amendment, there are really four dedicated funds: the Clean Water Fund, the Outdoor Heritage Fund, which is the topic today, Parks and Trails, and the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Annually, the Outdoor Heritage Fund recommends a bill that comes forward for approval that awards approximately $150 million to outdoor heritage projects in Minnesota to be used to really the focus by statute 97A.056 and direction is to protect, restore, and enhance wetlands, prairies, forests, and habitat for fish, game, and wildlife. Thanks, Joe. The statute's clear on the membership of the Lisard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council. There's 12 members. Eight of those members are citizen members, four appointed by the governor, two appointed by the House, and two appointed by the Senate. Citizen members serve a four-year term. There's two members from the Senate and two members from the House as well on this council that reviews recommendations, reviews proposals, hears from our partners, reviews recommendations, and then makes recommendations to all of you for these appropriations. Thanks, Joe. As I mentioned, the governing statute is 97A.056 to make these, review the appropriations and make recommendations to all of you for approval. Within the statute, it also calls out a small grants program that's administered by the DNR Conservation Partners Legacy Program. This is really to support local partners in a smaller scale effort to achieve the results of the Outdoor Heritage Program. These grants range from $5,000 to $500,000 and are about $9 to $15 million appropriated annually. This year, I believe it's about $12 million that's suggested to be appropriated. Oops, sorry. The first 16 years of the Outdoor Heritage Fund has achieved significant outputs. The legislature has allocated nearly $2 billion from the Outdoor Heritage Fund to restore, enhance, and protect habitat throughout Minnesota. These funds have leveraged an additional about $650 million, or about 35%, from federal, local, and private funding. And there's been over $100 million allocated to the Conservation Partners Legacy Small Grants Program, generating over $6 million in match funding or in-kind contributions, which has engaged thousands of local volunteers on the ground. In the first 16 years, pardon me, over 1.3 million acres of Minnesota wildlife habitats have already been restored, enhanced, or protected. Again, these small grants has funded over 1,000 grants to restore, enhance, or protect 585,000 acres. Within the CPL program, I think it's important to note that they have a category that emphasizes metro grants, and there have been a number of grants awarded, 230 grants in the first 16 years awarded to the 7-county metro area, as well as Duluth, Rochester, and St. Cloud. The statute requires these appropriations to consider the five ecological areas defined by the State Department of Natural Resources. You'll see on your map in front of you, those five areas are the northern forests, which of course are in the northeast area of the state, the southeast forest down in the southeast area of the state, our large prairie area, which is really southwest, and then the transition area between the forest and prairies. As well as a separate metro urbanizing area. With that, members, I'm going to turn it over to Assistant Director Pavelko to walk through some of the details and specifics of the accomplishments that have been achieved by the Outdoor Heritage Fund within these categories.
Please proceed, Assistant Director.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. Again, Joe Pavelko, the Assistant Director with the Lasard Sams Outdoor Heritage Council. I am looking forward to the egg roll queen out of the food truck section. So we are going to talk a little bit more about some of the outputs that the council has achieved over the last few years and then talk about the process. And then I'll also present just some pictures of showing you guys exactly what these dollars actually look like in the ground. If you look at this next slide, there's a whole bunch of numbers here. But Chair Vang wanted us to talk about the distribution of acres and funds between the ecological sections. So how much money is spent in the metro versus other parts of the state? And we did some calculations. And for the metro, this is for projects that have been completed and that they have final reports that have been put into and approved by the council. So that's not including projects that have been funded, you know, in the last couple of years. This is everything that's been completed to date. So to date, everything that's been completed in the final report, the metro has received 11.29% of the funds, and that's for 7.7% of the total acres. And the metro makes up 5.9% of the total area of the state. In the Forest Prairie Transition Zone, they have received 8.05% of the funds for 24.3% of the total acres, and they make up 11.8% of the total area of the state. The Southeast Forest makes up 7.48% of the funds allocated and 3.94% of total acres. And the Southeast Forest is actually the smallest area of the state at 4.8%. The Prairie, this is our largest area. They have received 48.86% of the funds for 35.18% of the total acres. And the prairie area here on that map is 33% of the total area of the state. And then finally, the northern forest, they've received 24% of the funds for 28.8% of the total acres. And the northern forest makes up 44.6% of the total area of the state. So as you can see, it kind of makes sense. So in the northern forest, there's a lot more public land and opportunities to do restoration enhancement work, and you have the ability to acquire large tracts of land. In the southwest part of the state, the tracts are smaller, but the costs are a lot more because you're working in farmland country, and it just costs more to do that kind of work. So it kind of makes sense. On the next slide, we thought we'd talk about the protection summary. So this is all the parcels that have been acquired to date, including parcels that were acquired recently with like 2 years ago's funding, but they don't have a final report. And you can see the largest area there is our easements. There was a very large easement in the very first 2 years of the fund, and that makes up 187,000 of those acres, but you can see there's still a good chunk of money going to easements, and that's, again, going all over the state. Fee and PILT, which we consider anything that's going to the DNR where they're going to be making PILT payments, that the total has been over 101,000 acres, and then fee without PILT is 70,000 acres, and that's land going to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. It could go to counties, cities, anything that's not DNR, and they're holding it in fee. So total to date, with OHF funding, 431,000 acres have been protected either via easement or fee title. Moving on to the next slide, here's just a breakdown of the easements. The largest holder of easements is DNR. They have those large Forest for the Future easements, and they can, you know, get 30,000 acres at a pop. That first one that I talked about was 187,000. There's just that kind of land base up in northern Minnesota that you're able to do that. Bowser easements, those are rim easements. So Bowser has a whole slew of programs that they receive funding for, and all of those put together over the years, they have protected over 73,000 acres. MLT easements, these are private land easements. They work all over the state, and that's almost 39,000 acres. U.S. Fish and Wildlife easements, these are easements that are managed for wildlife and migratory birds especially, but they also allow some working lands type use, so you can hay them and graze them and do certain things depending on the easement. And then the counties have also requested funds and received funds for their own easement program. So Hennepin County has an easement program, Dakota County has an easement program, Washington County has an easement program, and I think there might be one other county, but I can't think of it right now off the top of my head. Getting into the fee title portion of the protection, so fee without PILT, so almost 26,000 acres are going to, or have gone to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's waterfowl production areas, and these are properties that are owned by the Fish and Wildlife Service and managed specifically for migratory birds, and I'll talk about that in a little bit. The counties have received 30,000 acres of land. This is usually up north, and the counties request funding for lands that are going to their forest system. Excuse me. So these are working forest lands that the counties own and manage, and they just include them in their working forest management system. TNC owns some lands. These are lands that they acquire in fee. They manage them. They hold them in fee, and they also pay property taxes. And then there's also been a few tribal entities that have received funding for acquisition. I believe it's White Earth and Fond du Lac. And then fee with PILT, just a breakdown of how the state owns those acres. The majority of the land goes for wildlife management areas, a little over 5,000 for AMAs and SNAs and state recreation areas. And then again, because of there's opportunities in the northern forest, about 23,800 acres goes to state forest. I was thinking about why there's the difference if you're a pheasant hunter or duck hunter and you go out west and there's usually two types of properties that you can hunt on public lands. It's either U.S. Fish and Wildlife waterfowl production areas or wildlife management areas, and I was wondering why the acres are so different, but I think it's just because that the waterfowl production areas are very specific on what you can do, and they're only for migratory birds, so they're not managed to increase the deer herd numbers or things like that. So for folks that are worried about deer or, you know, worried about doing things in the northern forest or, you know, different areas of the state, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service waterfowl production areas may not be, you know, your best option. So that's why there's just, with the wildlife management areas, there's more options to manage for different wildlife species, in case you're wondering. So you're probably thinking to yourself, how do I get money? With all of those great projects, and I mean that's a lot of acres. How do you get money? And so I just wanted to go over the council's annual proposal process. So we let a call out for funding in early April. It comes back in May, so you have about 2 months to work on your proposal. Then the council reviews it in the spring, and then we have presentations in the summer, and then the council will make their decisions in the fall. And then based on the November forecast, we'll make a final recommendation. And then that recommendation goes to the legislature and hopefully it gets passed. So it is a long process. And that, because of that process, we can talk about that. But there are some drawbacks to that maybe, and why we have certain things or why projects look the way they do. Sometimes they're not always shovel ready. Council reviews the proposals. We look for accountability, conservation folks, focused, you know, whether or not they make sense, are they science-based. It's a competitive process, so it's a good review process. I'd encourage any of the members on this committee to talk to the current members and get more details about, you know, how they rank projects and what that process is like, but it's pretty robust. Who receives funds? So government agencies, the DNR and Bowser are the two state agencies that receive funds. Lots of local units of governments. There's been a ton of counties and cities and soil and water conservation districts and watershed districts. The one down south and by Freeborn, Shell Rock River, they have been requesting funds for almost 12 years or 14 years, and they've just really hammered it out of the park. I mean, they do great work. And then, of course, all the nonprofit organizations like Pheasants Forever and TNC and even some of the smaller, you know, there's been a few projects where smaller entities have received funds if their projects are over that $500,000 mark. Talking about from appropriation to habitat. So after they get funding, we have what's called an accomplishment plan. The accomplishment plan spells out exactly what they're doing, the who, what, why, where, when, has a budget, and that's like our guiding document that basically says here's what you can do and here's what you can't do. Talks about where they're doing the work, what types of projects they're doing, and it's very specific. And that's what we follow. So we follow the accomplishment plan plus what's in 97A.056. For NGOs that receive money, they actually enter into a contract with the DNR. So if you look at the language, it'll see like money going to an NGO. It'll say to the Commissioner of Natural Resources for an agreement with, you know, the Nature Conservancy. So the DNR, they are the fiscal side of that. And so they're the TNC and DNR actually have a contract in place, and they're the ones who run the fiscal side of that. So they do all the reimbursements, approve, you know, timesheets and all of that kind of stuff. They are required to use our online program management system, so they have to report to us of their status and how they're doing twice a year. Any amendment requests come to us and get approved by LSOEC staff or the council. If it's a large request that's a lot different and something that we're not comfortable approving, then we'll go to the council for approval at a council meeting. This is where we have all of our data management. So if you folks have any questions on how much money is being spent in my district or in my county or whatever, we have it in our data system and we can produce that for you. I will say that also when the money is on a reimbursement basis. So the partner has to actually spend the money, prove that they did the work, provide a receipt, and then they get reimbursed. So it's, nothing's fronted. There has been some advances periodically, I'd say like two or three in the whole history that I've been here for 10 years, and those are very extreme circumstances. So, you know, it's a good system. It keeps everybody in check because if they know that they have to spend the money and there's a chance that they're not going to get reimbursed, it keeps them, keeps things pretty tight. In 97A.056, there's some requirements. There's not only requirements on the council and how it's formed and all of those things, but there's also requirements on restoration enhancements. So restoration enhancements, they can only be on permanently protected land. That's only, so that's permanently protected land, meaning there's a conservation easement that's perpetual, owned by the government or a government entity, or it has to be within protected waters. They have to have restoration and management plans. They have to use the best science, and then interestingly, we also have the evaluation. So in 97A.056, 0.1% of all of the receipts has to go to the DNR for evaluations of the restoration enhancement project. So there's another level of oversight, not only fiscally, but there's you know, scientists and professionals that are going to go out and look at these projects and say, did they meet the requirements? Did they meet the goals of what they set out to do? Are these good prairie projects? Does this wetland look like a good wetland? There's a whole crew that goes out and looks at these, and it's usually about 20 projects a year. For acquisition, and this is both for fee and easement, you can't buy any temporary easements. It has to be permanent, so this is forever. All of the acquisitions have a NOFR, so known as a funding restriction, that's placed on the deed. And so if somebody were to sell that property or something would happen and somebody pulled the deed, they look at it and go, oh, there's a notice of funding restriction. I can't build this parking lot here or this without getting approval from the council and the legislature. And so you can see that it can't be sold or used for anything other than what it was intended for. And some of the members here on this committee receive emails from me about conversions and conveyances, and that's, we're going through that process where maybe the county road needs to be expanded a couple feet, and then it has to go through that process because of the NOFR, so it protects the state's interests. And then again, they also have to report annually on the property and make, they need to tell us that it's being used as it's intended. So we have, is it 4,000? We have about 3,000 to 4,000 parcels of land. And all of those parcels, they need to report to us every year that they're used in the manner that they said they were going to be used. And if not, then we have a talk with them and figure out what's happening. But, you know, it's, so far everything's been good. And here's just a map of the completed parcels. There's also a map of the most up-to-date completed parcel map in your handout. But it just shows that there's projects all over the state in every county. You know, some have some areas because of there's more habitat, just because of science and the way, you know, you want to focus your efforts. There's some areas that there's more focus than others, but it just, there's projects everywhere, literally thousands of projects that have been completed. And here's a map of the metro, just to show you that there's lots and lots of projects in the metro. And now we're just going to move on to, this is what it looks like on the ground. So it's really nice to talk about the numbers, but this is really what we're doing this for, and this is what we want to see. So just simple wetland restorations where, you know, it's a drained wetland there. You can see there's some cattails in it, but not really providing much for wildlife habitat. It might be some good thermal cover for, you know, resident pheasants or deer in the winter. But as you can see, there's a drain tile that goes through it, and this happens hundreds of times or even thousands of times so far with OHF funding. You go in, you break the drain tile. It slowly drains the wetland, but you break it, and soon comes back. Mm-hmm. And those, according to what I heard from the project manager, those wetland species were not planted. They just were in the soil bank and came back. Here's just a picture of a young guy, a Ducks Unlimited's employee's son. That's what we're doing it for. There's my son, happy. I wouldn't be a good dad if I didn't try and embarrass him.
I don't see any ducks.
Well, we'll talk about that, too. Shallow lakes. Shallow lakes is a big thing. So here's Butler Lake. This is in Meeker County. It's really close to Litchfield, and I've heard that if you climb up on the Opera House in Litchfield, you can see the lake.
Dean Erdahl.
I figured we'd have to talk about the Opera House sometime, right? So this is a lake that is privately owned. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service worked with partners to acquire easements to make this happen, so this is all privately owned. They used NACA money, so duck stamp money. When you buy a duck stamp, that money goes into a big pot, and then they use it for these kind of projects. So Fish and Wildlife used NACA money to acquire the easement, And then OHF was used to do the restoration of the project, and Ducks Unlimited did that. And this was a project that took, you know, like 15 years almost. I mean, these projects, these bigger projects, take a long time. You have to have a lot of buy-in from the local folks. But when they get done, they're phenomenal. And the water comes back. It's really cool. Here's Marsh Lake. We talked about this last year, but Marsh Lake is that huge lake out west. It's very, very famous for waterfowl use and migratory birds. And they drew down the lake, and I just want to read this quote from the DNR supervisor out there. He said, "Western grebes return to use and nest on the lake after the drawdown. Yellow-headed blackbirds are much more numerous as well. American coot numbers generally are greatly increased, and the number of terns on the lake this summer is certainly something to behold. In addition, increases in muskrat numbers have been an added bonus, with fowl house counts steadily increasing from almost none to over 1,000. So there's multiple species that benefit from this. It's not just ducks and it's not just geese that sometimes they're the thing that people think about, but all of these other species and even muskrats. How does a muskrat population go from 0 to 1,000? Like, where do they come from? Here's another thing that the council and the Outdoor Heritage Fund fund a lot, and that is complex buildings. So they're buying strategically areas out in the state that, like in this case, this is Tiger Lake, which is in the metro, in our metro section, just west of Norwood, Young America on Highway 212. So you could just hop on 494 here, hop on 212, and you'll run right into this. It's as you're heading west on Norwood, you look off to your right, there's a big lake, and then now there's all these small wetlands and grass, and that wasn't there 10 years ago. The lake was there, it didn't look very good, but now we have all of these other areas around it that are, they're slowly picking apart the area and finding the best spots to restore those wetlands and the grasslands. And so that's just you can see the first one was in 2013 and the last acquisition was in 2020, and I know they're working on more. So they're building this habitat complex, and that's what we like to see, and that's what science tells us is the best way to do that work out in farm country. You can see just this is a after picture. Before, those were all just, you know, corn and soybeans, and now they're, you know, very productive wetlands and grasslands. Another thing that the council funds quite a bit is hybrid cattail removal and treatment. This has been something that's been upcoming and is going to be a problem, I think, for the foreseeable future. The council has funded projects in Voyageurs National Park. The upper left picture is a machine that they use to cut the floating cattail mats and Voyageurs, and then another machine will come up and pick the cut cattails and bring them to shore. The council has funded the boom and the spray rig on a DNR helicopter there. That's on the right. And then they'll fly over large basins that are totally choked out with cattails and fly it and spray herbicide and kill the cattails. And hopefully that opens up the wetland for migratory birds to use. And then the left side, this is someone is actually in the water in waders using a weed whip of sorts to cut cattails. And so I just thought it was funny because every time I tell my son to go out and cut the grass, he thinks, oh, man, but having to go out in waders and do it is it's something else. Yeah, way more fun. Here's just a simple before and after grassland restorations, you know, pretty simple, but you can see the diversity in there. It's not just we're planting two or three species of grasses, but there's forbs, and if you're a pheasant hunter or bird hunter, you kind of know, like, at certain times of the year, pheasants kind of like to draw to the areas that are more diverse, that have probably more bugs and insects for them to eat, and seeds. Prescribed fire is another big thing. You know, prescribed fire goes all over. We're using prescribed fires in the western part of the state to manage grasslands. There is some prescribed fire going on in the northeast part of the state in the forest, but it is a little trickier and harder because if it gets away from you, you got major problems, whereas in the western part of the state, when you have grass surrounded by a bunch of black dirt, there's not as much risk. So we get a ton of acres in the grassland areas of the state. We get some acres in the northern part of the state. And then here's just a picture on the bottom left side of Voyageurs National Park. So they are cutting cattails, but then they're also burning them and using, you know, different techniques to try and figure out what's the best way to get rid of them. DNR roving crews, so the council realized how important it is for people to be on the ground doing this kind of work, managing and enhancing the lands that are already here that we already have. And so the DNR roving crews, they're funded on an every other year basis. It's approximately $13 million, and all that they are doing is doing habitat work. All of the money is paid for their staff time, and all they do is do OHF-related work. So they don't do any, like, any other thing that the DNR would do. It's just they're on a tractor, they are burning, they are planting, they are all year long cutting trees. That's all they do. They're a wrecking crew. So if you have project ideas, we are always available to help. We have a website that you can find our contact information. You know, you can talk to partners. You know, just reach out. But I think the thing that we've seen the most is that if you don't ask, you're not going to get it. So success always starts with applying for money. You know, we've seen a lot over the years. We understand the process very well, and we're here to help. We want people to be successful. If the program recipients aren't successful, then the OHF isn't successful. So it's really important, you know, that everyone's successful, and we want to help you. So reach out if you have, you know, a constituent that has an idea, or if you have an idea, reach out. We're always here for that. And now we'll move on to our new recommendations for this year, if that's okay, Madam Chair.
Yes, go ahead. Well, I think Co-Chair McDonald has a question for this presentation specifically, and so I'll open up briefly for questions for this specific presentation, then we can move on to recommendations. Co-Chair McDonald.
An excellent idea, Chair Vang. Thank you. Mr. Pavalko, regarding that weed whip that you're in the water, what kind of weed whip is that? And could a citizen do that at a wetland or a swamp that's in the backyard?
Joe?
Madam Chair and members, that's a good question. So that project was from Voyageurs National Park. So that was somebody that was hired to do that. And I know that when you're working in a wetland, you have to have a permit to remove vegetation. So they would have had to have a permit in place. Could a citizen go out in front of their dock and do that? I'm sure there's something that allows that. I don't know the ins and outs of that permitting structure, but I know that that's something you can't just do because you want to. There's restrictions in place in how you have to address that.
Co-Chair McDonald.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I figured that would be the answer that you'd give. Thank you.
All right. We have Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Pavelko, I don't think that in any way you meant to be offensive in one of your comments, but you did, in fact, say it was just corn and soybeans before, and my family has just farmed corn and soybeans for like 100 years, and many of the people in my district just farm corn and soybeans. So I don't know how many people earn their livings or their livelihoods hunting ducks or pheasants, but there are just a couple farmers in the state of Minnesota who just farm corn and soybeans. So I know you probably didn't mean that by any offensive manner whatsoever. I do think that our state and this program and what we do here need to also weigh heavily the fact that every acre of land that we buy is one less acre of land that a young farmer who's trying to make his way in this world or her way in this world can't have access to. So just keep that in mind as we're looking at purchasing thousands and thousands and thousands of acres for this program. There are many, many young farmers who can't afford the $12,000, $13,000, $14,000 an acre land that the state of Minnesota can afford, that this program can afford. They can afford the $14,000, but the young 28-year-old farmer cannot. So let's weigh that, and it's not just corn and soybeans. It's a huge portion of our economic driver in this state.
Representative Scraba. Oh, Joe, do you want to respond,
Madam
or Christina?
Madam Chair, members, understand and point well taken.
All right, Representative Scraba.
Thank you, Chair Vang. On the protection summary, the easements, the with pilt, without pilt, is it safe to say that when it is without pilt or if it's with easements, the county no longer gets property taxes in any way, shape, or form?
Director Joe.
Madam Chair and members, so with pilt means that the DNR owns it and will be paying pilt. So without right. would be the DNR is not paying pilt. So if it's going to, like if it goes to a county, you know, counties have asked for funds and received funds. Right. They own it, and they made the decision to own it in fee. So they, I guess, don't pay property taxes, but they will generate some income off of forestry practices.
Madam Chair. Representative Scraba.
Yeah. One of the issues that my constituents keep coming back to me and our county commissioners sometimes keep forgetting that the taxpayers pay the taxes, the county doesn't, okay? We are entering into these big land swaps with the Nature Conservancy and everything. We're talking thousands of acres, you know, to lock it up, to preserve it, you know. I sit on a district with a million plus acres that are preserved. You know, we get some pilt from it, but not a lot. And payment in lieu of taxes is what pilt is. Instead of taxes, you get a small stipend. Last year, we tried increasing that stipend in the legislature, and the governor said, how about we cut pilt? And then we quit trying to ask for more money. We just were trying to preserve what we have. So pilt, in if you're from areas where I'm from, you try to protect pilt. You try to grow it. Like southern Minnesota, lakeshore pilt is $42 an acre. Where I'm from is $4 an acre. So I'd like to equal it, try to bring it equal so that we have thousands of more acres than everyone else. There's no question. But we also gave up that land so everyone here and myself included get to use it. By no means am I saying, you know, take that land back. That's not what I'm trying to say. What I'm saying is when we buy this land from a private landowner, taking it out of production, taking it out of use, I hope that the land that we're purchasing is really only good for wildlife, not protecting it for the wildlife that might come, but that actually is right now. I use corridors as an example. If you have a wetland corridor and the farmer can't use it or the landowner can't use it, why not put it into this program? Then we know it's going to be there all the time and the animals can use it as cartways to get to and from where they want to go. I you know, I'm a supporter of that sort of thing. But if we're selling 187 or if we're buying 187,000 acres of forest land just to get it so we can use it as hunting, that's something I think the counties, the townships in there should have a say in, should have, and maybe you'll tell me they do or don't, but there should be some protection for the local taxpayers to say, why are you doing this? Show me why this is good for me. Then I can buy into it. And then I also have the Nature Conservancy, TNC, 8,077 acres, that fee title protection summary, do they hold on to that all the time or are they constantly trying to get either the federal government or state or county government to purchase it from them? I know where I'm from, they have some large tracts of land right now in queue if the federal money shows up, and I'm trying like heck not to get the federal money to show up because that is not what that land was meant for. That land was meant to use. It was private land and they bought it because they want to protect it. Again, that's thousands of acres that if you're from St. Louis County, you're going to pay more in property taxes because they're not once it's sold to the federal government. So I just want the public to know that there's a consequence for all of this acres. You know, you're going to pay more again, as a hunter, fisherman, outdoors person, I don't mind paying more if it's really the good land that is going to help enhance the wildlife. But if it's just to preserve or protect because someday someone might not want to do something on it, I'm a c'est la vie, let it happen. And if it happens, it happens. If it doesn't, you might find someone with a deep pockets and they're going to purchase that land and say, I'm going to preserve it. Great, pay the property taxes on it. That's awesome. Preserve it, please. When we do it, and then we end up paying for it. And here's the killer part that I get a kick out of. So we're going to get the land, and then we put it into PILT. So the property tax owner no longer pays taxes on it. The government gets the land. And if it's PILT land, now the government pays back to use it. There's some logic here that it better be really good wildlife protection land. So, but if you can get a question out of what I just said, go ahead and answer.
I think you had a question for the Nature Conservancy. I don't know if they are here, Director Christina or Director Joe, do you guys want to respond to Representative Scraba?
Madam Chair and Member Saul, I got two questions out of that. I'll talk about the first one. So TNC lands. So any lands that they acquire with Outdoor Heritage Fund dollars, they have promised that they are going to pay property taxes. So when they buy it and hold it, and you look on your Onyx map and it says TNC, then that they hold it in fee and they're paying property taxes. And they do some things to help pay property taxes, like they'll allow haying and grazing and have contracts like that to help pay for those property taxes. But they have made a commitment to that. Easements, they can, yeah. Yeah. But anything that TNC acquires without our funds, we can't control what they do with it. So, but just know that anytime they're acquiring land with Outdoor Heritage funds, they've made that commitment to pay property taxes. And there's actually some language in there, in the bill, in their section that talks about that too. And then the property tax on easements, that was another question. So when lands are eased, they also still pay property taxes. So like the Blandon Paper Company project, that was 187,000 acres. I know there were some growing pains and some discussion about how they calculated that tax payment, but they're still paying property taxes. And so all the RIM properties, they're paying property taxes. So that's all private land that they're, I don't know of any easements that I can think of that go into effect that you don't pay property taxes.
Representative Scraba.
Thank you, Chair. I use the Blandon land as an example. It's like the old potlatch properties used to be. The state of Minnesota, gave potlatch tax breaks, but the land was technically public, could hunt on it and use it to get to whatever. It was like public land, but they reserved the right to log it when they wanted to, and they got a break for it. And to me, that was pretty ingenious, whoever did that, because we got to use it as if it was ours, hunting. But at the same time, if they wanted to close it off to manage it, to cut it, they did. Then you couldn't do it anymore. And those were the rules, and you just went along with it. And if that's what Blandon, and that if the deal you work with, the dollar, the amounts, you can argue. I personally don't, that part doesn't bother me so much. It's just the use. If the public can still use it, that's important, because all you have to do is go to another state. Go to Texas and go hunting. There, you don't hunt without getting your checkbook out because there's no public land. And it sucks. It's terrible. It's the worst thing to ever be. So Minnesota should be proud of what we're doing. I just want to make sure that in the future, if we keep doing, and the real question that I have is there any trigger in this statute that says the county boards need to be addressed, have to have their blessings before we do these exchanges?
Director Joe?
Yes, Madam Chair, there is a subdivision in 97A. I just don't know it off the top of my head, but it requires notification to the counties. You have to notify them 30 days prior to closing that you're going to be acquiring properties. And that's only for fee title.
Representative Scraba.
And believe it or not, Representative McDonald, the question about the running the weed whacker in the water in Voyageurs National Park, there is someone in the room that works and lives on near Voyageurs National Park, and I don't know if he wants to answer that question. Do you know anything about it?
Oh, if you need a permit to cut cattails, yeah, well, certainly.
Sorry. Eric Johnson from International Falls area, they see that every day, the weed whacker out in the bay. What's the name of that bay?
Black Bay.
Black Bay. It's pretty impressive. You know, the national government is allowing this to happen. So it does, and it's not a weed whacker. It's a blade. It's the blade. So thank you.
Representative Cha.
Thank you, Chair. A couple questions there, Chair. See which one you want to answer. You know, Pheasants Forever and Ducks Unlimited have received over $150 million in funding over the past, history of these grants. Ducks Unlimited owns about 240,000 acres of land in Minnesota. These are two both nonprofits. My question is, the ownership and then the management and then the transfer of these land, does it come back to public ownership or do they retain these lands? Number two, are these lands accessed only for hunting or recreational? Can you give us some insight on that?
Director Christina or Director Joe?
Madam Chair and members, that's a good question. So I don't know if Pheasants Forever or Ducks Unlimited actually owns 240,000 acres in fee. They might own some, but their practice, at least with Outdoor Heritage Fund dollars, is they acquire it, they restore it, and then they give it to either the Fish and Wildlife Service as a waterfowl production area or to the DNR as a wildlife management area. And so, it makes sense because we want the wildlife professionals, the wildlife agencies to be in charge of those because they have the crews, they have the equipment, the know-how to do it. So it makes sense on that end. So depending on what type of properties are acquired with OHF, we'll let you know what you can and can't do on the property. So like a wildlife management area, you can hunt, you can fish, you can bird watch, you can walk out there, you can, I don't know if the rules have changed for foraging on that yet or what, but you could forage, you can basically do anything you want. You can't run motors, you can't take four-wheelers out there. Now, if we were to buy, say, state forests, you can do a lot of things. You can hunt, you can fish, you can camp, you can drive four-wheelers, you can do anything you want, bird watch, so it just depends on what you're doing. So Fish and Wildlife Service, those are federal properties. They are more restricted on what you can and can't do. And we've bought parks. We've bought, county parks. And obviously those you can do more because they're not so focused on wildlife but more on people and wildlife. So it just depends on the what you're buying.
Representative Shaw.
And I have one more question. We talk about soybean. I'm going to talk about cattle farming and grazing, right? Are there grazing opportunities on these, on these lands that is being funded through the Heritage Fund?
Yeah. Director Joe?
Madam Chair and members, that grazing has been an activity that has been growing over the years. So like even 15 years ago or 20 years ago, that wasn't something that was really done a lot. But over the years, it's become more and more. There's been projects where OHF funds crews to go out and build fences, like perimeter fences, and then they enter into an agreement with a farmer or a rancher, and they will rotate their cattle in there, and that's to give the cattlemen's private land some rest, and then they can use cows to basically manage the state properties, and then they can go back to the private lands to do more. So it's a win-win because they can get some sort of disturbance out there and not have to burn or, somebody can go do it. So it's used quite often. And there have been many NGOs like Ducks Unlimited and Pheasants Forever who are working out in the western part of the state who have their they have employees who do nothing but ranching and working on grazing systems and working with private landowners to get them interested in that kind of stuff.
Okay. And then we have Representative Burkle.
Thank you, Chair Vang. Really love the question, Representative Cha. That's one of my favorite projects, actually, the grazing projects. I love to hear that question. Thank you for being here. As a member of Lasard Sams, one of the tough jobs for me in my district is really, you know, as flat as we are in Northwest Minnesota, we have a lot of issues with flooding. Flood mitigation is a big deal. And a lot of these projects are synergies in how Lasard Sams works with funding in those areas. And one of the challenges I have is balancing that with the landowners and their rights and how water flows through my area as it goes to the Red River and north. It's a problem. But I'm curious, as these projects progress, can you just answer a quick question about, in the past, we've had a lot of project extensions. And I know there's been some issues on the committee as we've talked about permits and permitting, length of time for permits, permit reform. Could you address that?
Director Joe?
Yep. Madam Chair and members, that's a great question. So this past year, the council discussed the permitting process. We've just been hearing from some of the partners that it's just taking a long time. You know, especially when you're working in public waters, there's a process that you have to go through. And if the projects are large, which our projects are large because we have lots of funding, so you can actually do big, you know, good projects. So there's just a lot of requirements that go into it, from the engineering to the design to getting the permits, and then putting that dollar into the ground. So the council encouraged DNR to come in. The DNR came into a council meeting, and the DNR has committed to us that they're going to be working on like a continuous improvement project to talk about, to make the permitting process a little easier and more efficient. We're just in the starting stages of that. Hopefully by the end of the year we'll have something, but that's definitely something that everybody is cognizant of. Especially the project managers, when they're asking for funds, not only are asking for funds to do the construction work, but they've got to think back, okay, I think this project might take 18 months of permitting and, you know, to get it. So I have to, like, where do you start? When do you ask for monies? Like, some project managers will do some of that upfront work so that they know more, they have a better idea of what the costs are going to be, and they know that they can get the job done in the time that it takes within the appropriation period. And I'll talk about the second part of that, but we changed some of the appropriations this year in the recommended bill to address some of this lag time between how long it takes to get the permit to actually doing construction. So you'll see there's three projects in there that look like there's not much money in there, and that's for addressing that.
Representative Burkle.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks for addressing that. I think it's important for the public to know that in a lot of cases there's a ton of this money that's going into getting permitting done rather than to the projects themselves. So I'm glad the DNR has been able to talk about that process, and hopefully we can address it soon. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I don't think my coffee's as strong as Scrava, so I won't be able to go as long. I don't know what you got going on there. You really
pure energy, man.
I was wondering if Amy wrote all your stuff. No, sorry. No. Yeah, thank you for coming today, and I appreciate the new leadership, and hear you're doing a great job, so thank you. And the people that are still there do a good job. You know, I was lucky enough to serve on this commission, and some of what the questions have been, you know, how the land has been bought, and clearly the land really was, you know, in the first couple of years of the 16 or whatever, it was really bought up north, and there was, you know, that was the truth, and we had some big land purchases up there and other, and really the effort, you know, and in the last couple of years, and you'll see it with the dots. I'm impressed that you're all over the state now and really covering it, and that makes sense. I have a little bit, and I always have, a little bit of a Metro bias, so I would like to see more Metro purchases. I know the land's super expensive, and it's a little harder to shoot things maybe in the, but it's always amazed me. I always think of up in your district, Representative Heitzman, we toured that land right by the airport there, and we were on the trails, and we didn't see any deer or anything like all day for like, we're in there thousands of acres, and then I can go to Oakdale Park, and there's, they have to have special shoots because there's so many deer in the metro that, so anyways, I think our deer are a little more productive in the metro than than yours are, Josh. But I think you're going to have to do something about that. But anyways, I'm glad to see that you're continuing to do the small grant program. That was a labor of love. Representative Fabian, Representative Burkle, your predecessor, and me, and I'm kind of proud of that. And I think it makes a lot of sense that you're continuing that. I'm a little, I saw you or mentioned that it's going down a little. I don't, maybe the applications are down. I'd like to hear more about that, whether, you know, if you can provide us with some documentation or something. I'd also like to see where those grants went, if we can. I know I'm not on the commission, but I think it'd be helpful for members of this committee to see where the small grant programs are going, because that's something that people on, like in the metro, could apply, or even small communities from around the state. I believe Fergus Falls got, you know, some money through the regular way, but also small grants. Anyways, there's a lot of opportunities for that to be spent. I appreciate your presentation. I think it's, I always feel sorry for this a little bit, because it just, you almost have to get out there. And I was really happy to hear that Chair Vang, and I don't know if Chair McDonald, if you were there, but I know Chair Vang was, I heard, went to a Ducks, you know, went out and saw some on the land. When you get on the land and you see what's there for all of us Minnesotans with these funds, it's pretty powerful. And it's, I mean, it's something for everybody, for hunting and fishing. But if you're an environmentalist that cares about clean water, there's a ton of stuff that's going on, or carbon sequestration or whatever, you know, with the prairie restorations absorbing. So there's something for everybody, for Minnesotans. But it, so thank you for that. And I don't know how you would get that in your presentation, but I just really wish people, you know, that we could get people out there and see it. Because when you see it and you see the little birds and, you know, things that are just on the ground, it's just, it's pretty powerful. But anyway, that's more, Scrab, I'm taking your lead. It's more of a, it's more talking than a question. Thank you.
All right. I don't see any further questions. So we'll continue on with the presentation with I think Director Christina presenting on the recommendations of the Outdoor Heritage Fund.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members, for all of your questions. It's really helpful for me to hear these questions and better understand the insight, and clearly thank you to Assistant Director Pavelko for his deep expertise in this area. Just 2 points, Representative Burkle, on the permitting inefficiencies with the DNR. We have met with him, and we have a commitment to bring forward to the council this year recommendations. So we do want to keep that moving forward efficiently so that the council can consider those. And Representative Lilly, in my volunteer capacity, I was able to apply for and project manage a couple of those smaller DNR CPL grant programs, and they are really important programs to that scale of project, and the two projects I worked on were in Northern Washington County and the metro area. So we will get back to you on the questions that you asked regarding some of that data, and we'll just send that directly to you. So thank you for that. Chair Vang and legislative members, so moving on to the proposed bill that will be hopefully moving forward here in front of you, full fiscal year 2027. Again, it's the 18th year of the Outdoor Heritage Fund. With the recommendations, you'll find the summary here in this pamphlet in front of you. The Lasard-Sams Outdoor Heritage Council is recommending a total of 53 programs be funded by the Minnesota Legislature for a total of $188,922,000. It's estimated that there will be 68,754 acres of restored, enhanced, or protected wildlife habitat through these 53 appropriations, along with 40 miles of shoreline to be restored, enhanced, and or protected. There's an additional $15,129,000 in federal, local government, and private conservation funding expected to be leveraged through these appropriations. Those partners that are working hard on these include 29 individual organizations, including two state agencies, 11 local units of government, one university, and 15 nonprofit organizations. This continued investment for some of the programs includes 75% of the recommended funding, meaning previous appropriations, and continuing the good work and efficiencies of those previous appropriations. Some of the activities that will be included in the success of this work include native prairie protection, wetland restoration, as Mr. Pavelko discussed previously, trout stream enhancement, public wildlife land enhancements, shallow lake enhancement, forest fragmentation prevention, strategic land acquisition and fee and conservation easement, invasive species removal, restoring fish passage, and pollinator habitat improvements. With that, I would like to turn it again. To Mr. Pavelko to provide more of the details.
All right, Director Joe.
Madam Chair and members, so if you open your pamphlet there, we have on the left page, we organized everything by output of acres, and on the right side, it's output of funding. If you look at the acres, this year's slightly different than most years because we have two large projects in Northeast Minnesota, and you can see in the red there, protect in fee with PILT is pretty high, and the protect and fee without PILT is pretty high, so 19% and 32%, so getting close to 50% of the total acres is going to be fee title acquisition. If you go down to the bottom of the page, you can see how that's broken out between wetlands, prairies, forests, and habitats. There's nothing too odd to show here, except that you'll see where it says protect and fee without PILT and protect and fee with PILT under the forest section there. That's those high numbers there are because of those two projects. And then on the right side of the pamphlet here on output by funding, the funds look pretty normal, nothing too out of the ordinary. What's interesting is you can get a lot of acres in the forest region for quite a bit less money. So 52% of all of the acres that we're going to be doing with this bill is in the forest region, and it's only going to cost 26.4% of the total fund. And you can see as you go further west where it's more developed and there's less land to do work on, the costs go up. I'll bring your attention to the back side of this, and this is just the list of projects. The two projects that I want to point out to you with the two larger acquisition amounts is under subdivision 3 forests, 3A, Northern Forest Legacy Project. This is a project where the DNR is partnering with the St. Louis County, and both of them will be acquiring land from the Conservation Fund, and the Conservation Fund acquired some parcels from Potlatch, and that were going to be used for the land exchange with the Boundary Waters, and they changed the way they were doing the Boundary Waters exchange, and now I guess there's going to be a fee title sale to the federal government. And so St. Louis County and the DNR looked at those parcels and thought they would be a good fit. So St. Louis County is taking about half of the acres, and DNR is taking the other half. And then the other project is subdivision 3B, Sand Lake and 7 Beavers Acquisition and Enhancement. This is by the Nature Conservancy, and they will be acquiring a large tract in fee and owning it in fee, and so they will be paying taxes. It will be open to the public for hunting, but that's another large tract, and that's adjacent to another tract that they have already acquired, and that's actually right where that large fire was, the wildfire was last year. It's right in that area. And then the last three projects that I'll bring your attention to is subdivision 4F under wetlands. That's Talcott Lake. That's only for $1,000. That's a very expensive project, but it's only, we're only giving them $1,000. And then let's go to Mission, where is it? Little Cannon, so that would be subdivision 5T, Little Cannon River Stream Habitat Restoration with Clean Rivers, Great River Greening and Trout Unlimited. That's for $500,000. And then subdivision 5, letter Z, Minnesota Minnesota Statewide Trout Habitat Enhancement and Protection with Trout Unlimited. That's only for $750,000. And the way it worked out is that the council was just short on some funds. And knowing that these projects are going to take a long time on the front end to go through the permitting and the design work, so they decided, the council decided to fund them, give them enough money to get the plans going and have a good idea of what it's going to cost to do the work. And that will take, you know, anywhere from 1 to 2 years. That freed up some money to get other projects funded at a full amount, because that's what they needed. And then those three projects will come back after they've done the design and ask for the actual construction money. So it normally we wouldn't do that, but that's the way the council did it this year to address some of that, those issues.
All right, questions? Representative Scraba.
Could you go into a little more detail about the Northern Forest Legacy Project, about using our money to purchase lands in the Boundary Waters?
Director Joe.
So, Mr. Chair and members, so the Outdoor Heritage Fund will not be used to acquire lands within the Boundary Waters. The parcels that they were buying were previously owned by Potlatch outside of the Boundary Waters, and that's what they're acquiring. And that's throughout all of St. Louis County.
When you,
Madam Chair, Scraba.
When you say they're acquiring, they've already acquired it, have they not?
Director Joe.
Mr. Chair and members, so the Conservation Fund owns the acres, so they're owned by a nonprofit. And then DNR and St. Louis County will buy the land from the Conservation Fund, and then they'll become public.
Representative Scraba.
And originally that money to purchase those properties were going to come from the federal government on the land swap, but this got pulled out. Is that
Director Joe?
Mr. Chair and members, I don't know the exact details of how that all played out, but that's my understanding, that because the federal government is just buying in fee now and paying either the state or the county, I think, yep, it's the state who owns them, then those lands that the Conservation Fund, they didn't have a home. And so the DNR and the county went and perused that list and said, these are the ones that we want. They didn't, they're not buying every single acre. No. Some are going to be sold to, you know, in the private market, but they thought these are the ones that serve the best purpose for the Outdoor Heritage Fund and for the public.
Thank you.
All right. Further questions? Representative Cha?
Yeah, I've been on this committee for 4 years. And the name of this, you know, the Lasard Sams Outdoor Heritage Council comes up. So can you tell us who William Munger Lasard is and Jim Sams, who those two people are?
Director Joe?
Mr. Chair, it was Dallas Sams and Bob Lasard. Mm-hmm. And they are well-known in the conservation community as having a vision for the future. Bob Lasard is still around. He was at a dedication up by up by International Falls, I believe. So he's still around and doing some conservation work. But, you know, they, from what I understand, this was before my time, even in conservation, but that discussion about the legacy amendment was many, many, many years in the making and had many iterations to get to where we were when we passed in 2008, but they are very instrumental in that, doing that.
All right, Representative Cha. Oh, Chair McDonough.
Thank you, Chair Vang. Mr. Pavalko, how many are the acquisitions for your request this year for this bill? Is there any productive farmland that is being acquired or up for sale?
Director Joe.
Mr. Chair and members, it's possible. It depends on what your definition of productive is. You know, when Pheasants Forever or Ducks Unlimited are going out and looking for properties, they're looking for properties that they can restore. So they're looking for wetlands that are drained. They're buying land from usually farmers that are done fighting, you know, with the area because they just can't get a crop out of it. But what they're really looking for is that low productive because they want to restore the wetlands out there. So it's usually not the best. You know, there could be some acres part of the acquisition that could be considered good, but then, you know, sometimes the landowner wants to sell everything they own and they don't want to parcel it off and go through that process. But for the most part, we're buying the not the best stuff, and it has the potential for restoration. So there's a ton of work that goes in beforehand about identifying those parcels, and they do some surveying work to make sure, hey, if we spend $1 million on this project, we want to know that we can restore this wetland. So there's a lot of work that goes in on the front end to acquire those.
Chair McDonald.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, you teed it up perfectly, Mr. Pavalko. Yes, Representative Lilly, Chair Vang and I met in my district just 4 miles from my photo studio in Wright County and toured three pieces of property that restoration. And it was quite impressive. Mark Johnson was there to meet us and several folks from Ducks Unlimited, and also Miss Kim Scott, who has invited us to go duck hunting, and that's another story that I'll tell briefly. Anyway, so we have witnessed, of course, I've driven past some of these properties for 35 years or so, or at least the last 20 that they restored, and they are magnificent. The wildlife and the waterfall that they brought forth to these farmlands that were just wetlands and unproductive, to be sure, and given the families an opportunity to sell the land and have a little cash in their pocket and then have land to bring back for our future generations and our generation great wildlife habitat. So I am very aware of the importance and the great work that you're doing and support that, but still we all must be concerned with as Representative Olson so urgently urged, be careful not to bring too much productive land out of production that feeds the world with our soybeans and corn. But good to hear that it is low production land that does good for our environment, our wildlife habitats, and the farmers who own the land and said, this is enough, we can't plant anything in this land. And then Ms. Scott invited Chair Vang and I to go duck hunting in Buffalo in Wright County, so I didn't have to drive far. But Chair Vang must have been, she was wise to skip it because it was the coldest day of the last weekend of duck hunting. And while we're out in the boat in the duck stand, the lake was freezing around us. I mean, literally freezing. So, and then the motor wouldn't start. And then a storm came in, and the ducks did not. But we had a very lovely time, didn't we, Ms. Scott? So, Chair Vang, on the beginning of duck season this year, we'll go in the beginning when it's nice and warm.
All right. Let's plan on that, Chair McDonald. I don't see any further questions. And so thank you so much, Executive Director Christina and Assistant Director Joe, for being here today and presenting before the committee. And as always, feel free to follow up afterwards, too, if members have any more questions. And so we have one more quick update from fiscal staff, Mr. Hagemeyer, to talk about the legacy fund balances. We will have a forecast later on Friday, but a quick update from Mr. Hagemeyer.
Sure. Madam Chair, I'll be going off the one-page sheet in the packets. It says Minnesota House Fiscal Analysis on top and Legacy Finance. It's dated 12/10. This is from the November forecast of balances. And just stepping back, at a high level, the first handful of years of the legacy funds, there wasn't a reserve requirement for any of the funds, and a lot of them were spent to 0%, 1%, 2%. and subsequent forecasts or tax changes could make them go negative. And we had a few years where forecasts had funds negative, and it's not ideal to have to go back and cancel grants and things legislatively. So about 10 years ago, there is language added into the statutes for each of the funds to maintain a 5% reserve when appropriating funds. So we do a calculation every forecast so that you know about how much is available on the 5% reserve. Again, this will change on Friday with a new forecast. Looking at the sheet, all the appropriations were made last year based on the February of 2025 forecast. And so if you go off a 5% reserve from then, you're going to have four more forecasts before the end of the biennium when those funds are appropriated. So a lot can change in that time period. And you could also have tax bills that expand or contract the sales tax base too, which could affect the outcome of that too. And those are less predictable for timing-wise of when things are going to pass. So based off of these, just the changes from February of last year to November of this year, there was a close of the fiscal year in there. So you have the final numbers for fiscal year 2025, both the revenues, the investment income, and then the final amounts that are spent. So if there's any money that canceled, the project didn't fully spend their funds. So you have those three changes for fiscal year 25. You also have the changes in fiscal year 26 for anticipated revenues and anticipated investment income, as well as fiscal year 27, since some of those funds are appropriated already, you have the anticipated revenues and investment income on those years as well. The numbers are up, but that was primarily driven by a change in how the investment income is allocated, and some of these funds are held a little bit longer, especially Outdoor Heritage, since some of the projects take 5, 6, 7, 8 years. There's money sitting that's been appropriated, so there's a few hundred million there, so it gets some interest on it. So the amount of investment income was significantly increased in this last forecast, so that gave some balances to the fund. And then looking at this sheet, as you know, the Outdoor Heritage Fund is annually appropriated. The others are biennial appropriations. And the Outdoor Heritage Fund was able to react to the new numbers on the November forecast. So they're expending, as you see a bolded box on the FY 25 or 27 column, of $188 million. And that's how much is being recommended in the bill. It will be before you soon. And then looking at the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund, the biennial appropriations were made last year already. So fiscal year 27 was included in there, but there is a little bit of positive revenue that could be spent down to the 5% reserve of $583,000. This one, just so everyone is aware, there is a statutory requirement of 47% for the arts. So if the governor does make recommendations, he always recommends the 47% that goes to the state arts board, but then there's usually no other recommendations on that, and the legislature makes those up. But if there was an interest in spending the money, 47% would typically go to the arts board. Going down to the Clean Water Fund, there's $7.1 million that could be appropriated. Again, these have the biennial appropriations were already made. This would be on top of that. And Clean Water Council, which is made up of legislative members, citizen members, and the agencies, some are voting, some are non-voting, make recommendations on that to the governor and the legislature. The governor also makes recommendations on the Clean Water Fund. I don't know if there'll be supplemental ones or not. They're typically, the last few years have been the same as the Clean Water Council, but they aren't always. They haven't always been in the past. And then the legislature could certainly make changes if they want to as well. And then the Parks and Trails Fund, there's about $1.8 million positive balance there that could be appropriated if chose to be, but there were biennial appropriations made. And the last 10 years, or a little bit more, I think now we've been going on the 40-40-20 split between state parks, metro parks, and then regional parks, or statewide parks of regional significance. So that's kind of the process that goes for that. And the governor does make recommendations on the Parks and Trails Fund typically, if there are supplemental recommendations or not. Again, these will all change on Friday, and I can give you a new update next week if we have numbers or following week.
All right, questions? Chair McDonald?
Thank you, Chair Vang. Question, Mr. Hagemeyer, it might be a parochial question, but with these funds, are they sitting in just our general fund, but not in a money market or a fund that we can gain interest? Is that a parochial question, or should I know that, or is it
Mr. Hagemeyer?
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, they are each other. They're each in their own dedicated fund, Outdoor Heritage Fund, right. Arts Culture Heritage Fund. So they're not in the state general fund. Unless funds are otherwise specified, we have a few things that go to like the State Board of Investment where they can invest them in securities and things like that, like the Closed Landfill Investment Fund and things like that, where they can receive a higher rate of return. I don't believe there's anything that specifies these can be invested in things like that, but they do receive
an interest rate. We always, it's a ITC rate. Any cash the state has on hand, like basically overnight, is able to be invested. The last couple of years, those have been high. Basically, think of like a bank account rate where for a number of years you were getting almost nothing on it, and then all of a sudden you were able to get some money on it the last few years, and there's been a lot more interest in the last couple of years just based on those. Basically, you know, it's still a small interest rate, but there's a lot of money sitting there, so it's been invested like that. You'd have issues if you were to try to invest these balances because they are appropriated and available to be spent or reimbursed to the grantees at any point. So both appropriating the money out to be expended and putting in an investment account where, you know, you'd need some flexibility on how long things are invested for to actually gain interest on them would cause some issues.
Chair McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Hagemeyer. Yes, I knew there were, when I said general fund, I know they're dedicated funds, but I just, you know, what bank account? But so it is safe to say that some of it is gaining interest and making some money on for the taxpayers of Minnesota. That's all I wanted you to clarify. And
Mr. Hagemeyer.
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, if you look on, I wrote the investment income line on here. So if you look under Outdoor Heritage Fund, it's like the third call or third row down. For fiscal year 26, like Outdoor Heritage Fund has over $15 million of interest accruing to it. If you look back a handful of years, it was maybe like $1 million, $1.5 million, something like that. So that number has changed significantly. And on the last forecast, where MMB and revenue kind of changed how that's being allocated to the funds, it was significantly increased in this last forecast.
Chair McDonald.
Very good. Thank you. Thank you for pointing that out, Mr. Hagemeyer. And it, I guess it was a pretty good question then, huh?
All right. I think that is all that we have. I still see that Executive Director Christina, you're still, do you want to have, do you, this is your first committee, so I want to give you at least more indulgence. Do you have any closing remarks before we adjourn?
Thank you, Chair Bang, legislative members and staff. Again, it's a privilege to be here. I have a lot to learn. I'm very excited to be working on behalf of all of you and the citizens of Minnesota in this really excellent program. Please reach out anytime if you have any questions or if you'd like to connect on anything. I would love to hear from all of you. Thank you.
Right. And then Chair McDonald, do you have any closing remarks?
Well, Madam Chair, we have 3 minutes. I don't, other than it's good to be back at the Legacy Committee. This is a committee, as I said last year, that we all work well together and do good things, great things for Minnesota. So welcome back, team, and all those who are moving Minnesota forward in an environmentally safe area.
All right. Next week, you will have the gavel, and so this meeting is adjourned.